We are joined here live in the studios by Maria Tomchik, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good to have you back.
Thank you.
We get you back, and then we don't have Jav today.
So. No Jav today, but hopefully he'll be back next week.
We will perhaps have both of you in the same place at the same time. All right, so just got in this week, a fresh off the press, or fresh from under the inking pen, the Mercer Mega Block giveaway documents.
excuse me. Yeah, Erica Barnett, who does the blog, The C is for Crank, she's a local journalist, she had requested the unredacted proposal that Alexandria Real Estate had made to the city for the purchase of the Mercer Mega Block. And initially the city said that she could be subject to a lawsuit because they had not redacted it. It was the developer, Alexandria, that had redacted it, and that they might sue to keep that information secret. But the city, out of the blue, just released the unredacted proposal to Barnett this week. And in the unredacted version, which Erica Barnett has posted on her blog, The C is for Crank, we can finally see how many of the affordable housing units will be set aside for family housing. Now, the proposal that Alexandria made to the city said that they would build 175 units of affordable housing. Only 11 out of that total of 175 units will be set aside for families making less than 60% of median income. Of those 11 units, 8 will be two-bedroom units that will have an average of 900 square feet, and that's pretty small for a two-bedroom, and only 3 units will be three-bedroom units with an average of 1,240 square feet. 3 units. And like I said, this is really small for family housing. For example, the national average for a two-bedroom unit is 1,138 square feet, which makes these affordable units 21% smaller than the national average. Now, the rest of the affordable housing will be studios. There will be a total of 50 of those studios, and there will be 114 one-bedroom apartments. Rent Cafe reported late last year that Seattle has the smallest rental housing in the nation among 100 large cities that they surveyed. We average 711 square feet per unit. That's all unit sizes, from studios all the way up to three bedrooms. While the national average for all apartments is 882 square feet. That's 24% larger than what you can rent here in Seattle. Now, and that 711 square feet per unit, that's actually 3% smaller than apartments in Manhattan, New York, which is notorious for its tiny rental units.
So are people just smaller here?
No, it's what the market offers and what people are willing to or eventually have to settle for when they go out looking for an apartment. Now, note that the national average for studio apartments is 514 square feet, and that's about the size of my one bedroom right now. That's the national average for studio apartments. And the 615 Dexter building that Alexandria wants to build is going to have studios that average 340 square feet. That's more than one-third smaller than the national average. And I have to say, I don't think that 340 square feet is sufficient for a lot of folks. Now, the national average for one bedrooms is 757 square feet. And I just kind of revealed that my one bedroom's a little over 500 square feet. And again, the 615 Dexter building's one bedroom units will average 550 square feet, which is 27% smaller than the national average. Now, this is in spite of the fact that the city is giving Alexandria a break on the sale of the property that averages out to about $217,000 per affordable housing unit that they're going to build. That would make sense if all of that housing was actually family housing, two-bedroom and three-bedroom units. But only 6.6% of the units, a total of 24 out of 365 that are going to be in that building, because it's going to include some market-rate housing too, could reasonably hold a family of more than two people. And it's debatable whether two people can sanely live in a 550 square foot one bedroom unit. I would argue that you can't. I mean, I tried it in a 600 square foot one bedroom unit, and it was tough living with another person there. And 550 square feet, really, that's probably sufficient for one person, but I would say not for two people. So it's worth asking too, what rents are Alexandria going to be is Alexandria going to be charging for these apartments? For the affordable units, the studios will vary from $878 up to $1,427 per month. That's for a studio, okay? Now, one bedroom, and these are the affordable units, not the market rate units. One bedrooms are going to vary from $1,411 up to $1,883 per month, which is more than I pay for my one bedroom unit. And these are, again, supposed to be the affordable units for people making 60% of median income.
So, and that's the projected starting cost? Because
that's the
economy
starting.
Changes, then couldn't that go up by the time they get them complete?
They're hoping to get them complete in a year and a half to potentially open within a year and a half to 2 years. So that's looking forward a year or two for these units. And the two-bedroom units are supposed to rent out at $1,692 to $2,399, the affordable units, you know, for a small three-person family. And I would argue that that's not exactly affordable, and that there's going to be a lot of people who won't be able to afford that. But where it gets really ugly is when you look at what Alexandria wants to charge for the 145 additional market-rate apartments that they're going to be putting in the same building. The studios, for 340 square feet, $2,000 a month. Yeah, figure out who's gonna be paying that. Now, the one bedroom units, which they're building the most of, for 550 square feet, $2,550 a month. Yeah, that's insane. And for the little handful of 900 square foot two bedrooms, they're gonna charge $3,950 a month. And for the three bedroom units, they want to charge $5,350 for 1,240 square feet. And you look at that and you just say, you might as well be buying a house at that point. Literally, anything under $1 million, you'd come out ahead rather than renting one of those three-bedroom units. But then again, they're only building three-bedroom units to rent at market rate. So this building is not meant for families at all. 135 of those 145 market rate apartments are going to be studios and one bedrooms, and only 7 are going to be two bedrooms. Only 3 are going to be three bedrooms. So, you had a question.
Well, right? Obviously, the buildings are multi-purpose. I'm assuming at least some of the space is going to go towards a bank that's going to be all this money is going to be flowing into.
Right. Well, they do have commercial. They do have commercial. Space marked out in the ground floors of the two office buildings that they're going to be building.
Okay, and that's where the armored car will pull up. And
yeah, they haven't said who's going to rent out that space, but I imagine there will be a bank going in there. There are already some banks in South Lake Union. But anyway, in addition, I want to point out too, Alexandria has said it will be using a cheaper construction system, one that uses pre-manufactured dwelling units that will save them a boatload of money on constructing the housing portion of this development.
Oh, good. So more profit to them for sticking their neck out so far on this deal.
I know.
Seems only fair.
Yeah. And then I also want to point out too, looking at the unredacted proposal, you can see there's going to also be a big below ground parking garage built in the Mercer Mega Block site, probably in the commercial towers, which will hold 807 vehicles. Now, the average square footage devoted per vehicle in this garage, when you take into account the parking spaces and the, you know, the drive-in areas and you know, the drive-through portion where you drive around searching for parking, that's going to average out to 432 square feet per car. Okay? That's bigger than... that's bigger than the space devoted to a studio apartment for people living in the housing portion of the building. Yeah, that's 27% more space for each parked car than provided in each studio apartment in the 615 Dexter building.
But for people that are forced to live in their vehicles, this is actually looking pretty good if you can get one of those spaces.
Yeah, it could be good. And I want to point out, too, this is in a neighborhood with its own streetcar line. served by bus routes number 8, 62, 63, 64, 70, 309, and the C Line Rapid Route Bus. And it will eventually have two light rail stations. It's also, if you walk from that site to downtown, it's about a 20-minute walk to downtown, to and from downtown. And actually, the walk from downtown is a nice, easy downhill walk. So the question is, why build any parking at all? And I think the answer to that is that clearly this is a development for the bosses, who will have their own reserved parking in the parking garage. They'll be able to live in their palatial suburban mansions, right, and drive in to work. And they can hire kids out of college to live in tiny dorm-style apartments and walk to work for them. That's essentially what the Mercer Mega Block development is going to be.
Or perhaps for the businesses that will be in that area, they can buy those units and then use them for out-of-town.
Well, yeah, guests. You anticipated me. In fact, Fred Hutch has already asked Alexandria to reserve at least a portion of the affordable units at 615 Dexter for their postdoctoral grad students to live in, because those postdocs can't afford Seattle rents. And it's within walking distance of the Hutch. So, you know, they don't have to have a car and pay for parking. So here you have Fred Hutch taking advantage of, okay, yeah, we'll employ these postdocs. And they can't afford Seattle rents. So that's what they want a large part of the building to be devoted to. And the city's okay with that. The question is, of course, if you're older than 30 years old and you're not making six figures a year, but you need to work in downtown or South Lake Union, where the heck do you live?
Yeah. Well, when you say the city's okay with that, that's really
the mayor's
office. Durkin administration is okay with that.
The Durkin administration.
We have yet to hear from city council about this.
Some city council members, like, for example, Shama Sawant's fine so far with the Mercer Mega Block proposal and doesn't see any reason to vote it down. And I'm sure that most of the other city council members on the face of it think it's a great deal, because there's all this money that's going to be flowing in to build affordable housing that from the cash that Alexandria is paying for this land. Now, the mayor made a big deal about how the Mercer Mega Block sale is going to get us all of this affordable housing. But really, when you look at the deal itself, there's not going to be a ton of affordable housing with it. And it's not going to be affordable for the people who really need it, families that make under 60% of median income. It's really no different from business as usual. And it's really the money that is going into this big pool for affordable housing, the cash that's coming out of it, that's going for affordable housing. And they're estimating somewhere around $70 million eventually that may go into affordable housing from the Mercer Mega Block sale. The city now sits at a turning point. They're getting all this cash from the sale. They're getting cash from other sources as well. They have the opportunity now, instead of just doing business as usual, which is contracting with private developers to build a certain number of affordable housing units, you know, they could set up a system whereby the city contracts with nonprofit developers to buy land and turn it into public land, to contract with nonprofit builders who can build green without having to have an enormous profit margin like private developers do, and nonprofit managers who can manage that housing and keep it in decent shape for the long term. The city can do that now that they're starting to get these millions of dollars into their housing fund. It's just a matter of will. And what I would love to see, I know a lot of activists are still focused on the Mercer Mega Block sale and trying to get the city council to vote against it. I don't think that's a winnable fight. I think the place where you need to put your energy in is in how the city moves forward with the money it's getting out of the Mercer Mega Block sale and from other sources, and in where it puts that money in terms of buying land and how that land is built for and managed for affordable housing. If we can also put effort into things like cooperative housing, that's something that some groups have done here in the city of Seattle, and I think they've done quite successfully, but it's been done more successfully and much more widely in other cities around the world. Cooperative groups who get together and take housing out of the hands of private developers and private landlords and turn it into cooperative housing where the profit motive is removed and that housing can stay affordable for generations, I think that's a very worthy goal as well. And if we had a movement towards that here in the city of Seattle, I think we could make a real impact. Because if you look at it, I'm going to talk about this in, well, I'm just going to go right into it, some of the other affordable housing news. If you look at it, the city and the county are going to have hundreds of millions of dollars to work with. If that all gets poured into private developers and private developments where, you know, they get a tax exemption if they maintain, you know, affordable housing for 20 years or 40 years or whatever, eventually that's going to revert to private ownership. And, you know, the next generation is going to have this same problem all over again. We need to have a system and use the money that we're getting, the influx of money that we're getting now to change directions, to go in a new direction, and to shelter some of our land supply from the private market, really.
Well, but again, it seems like having some serious reflection and still making tweaks to this current deal, or at least illuminating how a deal like this takes place, seems really important. Because again, the first key factor is having land.
And,
and as
and
I
here we're giving
understand
it away.
That,
not
this
giving
was
it away,
set up
but,
as to be a lease. That was the initial
thing
from
plan.
Alexandria, was that they were going to lease and it was going to remain in our ownership.
Yeah, but here's the deal. That lease would have only provided about a little over $30 million in cash to the city. The city had already borrowed more money than that just to buy that property, you know, and along with the accumulated interest on that. But the city had also borrowed additional money against the future sale of that land. So the city would have been in the hole if they had taken a lease agreement instead of a full sale. Now, I was pushing for, okay, sell the two big plots of land and keep the housing portion as city-owned land, use the cash from the sale of the commercial property to build and manage public housing, which I think would have been a better deal. And they might have gotten a better deal out of Alexandria if the city had presented it that way. But they weren't thinking ahead. And the officials in the Durkin administration didn't really come back with a counteroffer and they didn't ask Alexandria to say, hey, what if you buy the two commercial pieces and you don't buy the public the housing portion, but you do develop on and we do contract through you with a developer to build that housing? You know, the city didn't really look at anything like that. I don't think people were really thinking about it in those terms.
And perhaps the same way that
but we need to start thinking in terms like that.
And the same way that like the folks at the Seattle Displacement Coalition point out that if you're going to remove an affordable housing unit, that you need to replace it with you need at least one-to-one replacement for all the ones you're taking out there.
Mercer Mega Block didn't have affordable housing.
No, I understand that. But I'm in terms of long-term solution here, looking from the city standpoint, how is it that the city can even consider giving away public property, you know, without replacing it
because
it's a losing gambit.
Yeah, they're not giving it away. They're selling it.
Well, agreed.
Yeah.
But you're still
losing
it. But
I hear you.
It's eventually being swallowed up by private owners.
And the city's argument is that that was commercial land to begin with and that it's not in a great area for housing. And I would argue that that's not true, that it was a great area for housing because it's on major transportation corridors. You've got a bike lane there. Like I just said, you've got all these
cream
transit,
waterfront in another 20 years.
You've got all these transit routes. The view will be beautiful out of the upper floors of those buildings. And if the city had done a deal, even selling the two main plots and keeping the third plot for housing, the city had done a deal saying, you know, it's great that you want to put a city community center in there, but can we get a school and a playground? Then that and kept that housing piece for true family housing, that would have been a major start on getting towards the goal of housing families who make less than 60% of area median income. So I want to talk a little bit about some other affordable housing news, too.
Okay.
The King County Council voted this week to claim a portion of the state's sales tax money that the legislature set aside for affordable housing. On Wednesday, the county council voted unanimously to claim about $100 million in state sales tax revenue over the next 20 years for affordable housing that would serve people who make less than 60% of area median income. This is money that would otherwise go into the state general fund. The state legislature voted earlier this year to make those funds available for counties and municipalities that want to claim that money to use for affordable housing. Now, Seattle had already voted earlier this month to claim a $4.5 million annual share of those funds, which they could leverage to eventually borrow about $50 million to build public housing. Other cities in King County could also vote to claim some of those funds, up to perhaps another $100 million. And they could use the money, larger municipalities could use the money to buy land and build new affordable housing. Smaller ones could use it for rental assistance to create affordable units in existing private buildings. Last year, the Regional Affordable Housing Task Force concluded that King County needs to build or convert about 244,000 units of affordable housing by the year 2040. That would be approximately 11,619 units per year to keep up with the need for affordable housing in the county. And I want to point out, too, that the recent homelessness count in King County found around 12,000 people living on the streets right now. So that sounds about right. An estimate of about a quarter of a million units seems by 2040 seems about right. That's a lot of housing. That $100 million that the county council just voted to claim would pay for the construction of about 250 units of family housing at current market rates. That's really how expensive it is to build here in this region if you use private developers, as the city and county have done up until now.
So that would address about 1% of what we need.
Yeah, exactly, about 1% of what we need. So with that money in the pipeline, like I said, Seattle and King County have the opportunity to say, do we need to use private developers? Do we need to spend $200,000 a unit to build housing for that? Or can we set up a system whereby we spend half or less per unit to build public housing and use nonprofits to manage it in the future? So, you know, I just want to say I'm making a big push for this. And what I would really love to see is I'd love to see one of the current council members, or preferably one of the new council members starting in the new year, stand up and say, okay, we got this money for affordable housing. I am willing to meet with Dow Constantine. I am willing to work with the new regional housing authority, if we can put one together, to start up a system whereby we use nonprofit developers, we use nonprofit management, and we buy lands and turn them into public housing that will house people. In addition, they need the city and the county need to get together and come up with some kind of plan to take housing out of the hands of private landlords, to eventually move it out of the hands of private landlords and into some kind of cooperative management, or into a new public housing authority, because we simply can't build that quarter million units by 2040. We can't build it all. It's going to be way too expensive. Even if we manage to cut the costs by half, we wouldn't be able to build it all. We need to convert some. So there needs to be a plan for how to do that.
Even if we could build it with the existing system and protocols, mm-hmm. it's just not a good use of the money.
No.
It's,
and you know,
mismanagement at best.
Well, yeah. And so I want to urge people, when you go to these council candidate forums and you talk to city council members and you ask questions, to ask a question of do you have any plan in terms of affordable housing? What's your plan for the future? The county needs a quarter of a million units by the year 2040. You know, how do we get there? And see how they answer, or ask them point blank, are you willing to work with King County to get a public housing authority started, or to get public land converted to public housing? You know, and see how they respond to that. You know, see if some say, well, I believe more in public-private partnerships. That's your that's the little light bulb that should tell you, okay, this is the person that wants to use private developers and is willing to spend $200,000 a unit to build less housing than we need, versus, wow, that's an interesting idea. I am interested in moving towards public housing or moving towards things that can convert housing from market rates to more of more affordable housing. And there are ways to do that. I mean, you don't necessarily have to buy land and turn it into public housing. You can do things like impose rent control, for example, and there are many, many different ways to do this to lower rents and make housing more affordable. You can subsidize apartments in older buildings. You can provide incentives for landlords to hold down rent increases and to keep older buildings in the housing stock. There are many different ways to go about this conversion of housing from the, you know, gotta build and replace to new luxury apartments every 10 years or 20 years. You know, there are many ways to go about this. And passing laws that could encourage the formation of cooperative housing would be really a central first step, I think.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
It seems like an issue we might possibly be...
Oh, we're going to be revisiting it. Yeah, we're going to be revisiting it. And now, also, there's some movement this week, even though the city council was on a break. There was some movement this week on transportation issues, particularly around bicycle transportation. Next week, the city council is going to vote. The full council is going to vote on Tuesday on three or four issues related to bicycle transportation. I think they're going to discuss it and vote on it from around 2 to 4 p.m. next Tuesday. The Mass Coalition, that's the Move All Seattle Sustainably Coalition that includes a whole bunch of transportation groups from Cascade Bicycle Club to the bicycle blog to even disability rights groups, have gotten together and put together a transportation package of really good ideas, I think, for getting the Seattle Department of Transportation to work on what the Mass Coalition thinks are the most important transportation issues, things like building out more sidewalks and widening sidewalks, particularly to help people with disabilities get around Seattle, but also to allow everybody to do more walking and make the city more walkable, to creating more bus lanes for bus rapid transit, to building out the bike lane system, to providing more on-street parking for bicycles, which I think is very desperately needed in the city of Seattle. Just recently here, the Seattle Department of Transportation released their report on the bike share program in the city of Seattle, showing that in the first quarter of the year, people took almost 900,000 trips on bike share bicycles in the city of Seattle. But there still remains the issue, and the report admits this, SDOT admits this, there still remains a big issue with people improperly parking bicycles in ways that block sidewalks and make it very, very difficult, particularly for people with disabilities to get around. But not just them. I mean, I walk a lot in the city of Seattle. I walk just about everywhere that I don't take the bus. And I tell you, it irritates me to no end how some bicycles are parked around the city. It just makes it really, really difficult sometimes and can make the sidewalks an obstacle course. Yeah. But in my neighborhood, there is just right outside my building a parking space that's devoted to bicycles. And I only ever see a couple of bike share bikes parked there, even as around the corner I can see them parked all along the sidewalk. So I think the city needs to not only make those parking spaces need to make more of those parking spaces. They need to let bicycle share users know where those spaces are, and they need to make them more visible. Now,
same with the bus lanes as well. They need to actually have those for buses as opposed
and
to
make them more visible and
not for
increase
just people driving.
Increase enforcement,
as we've seen with popular videos circulating of people stepping out into the bus lanes to redirect cars back into where they're supposed to be.
Yeah, where you have neighborhood residents saying, "Hey, get doing the actual enforcement of the bike of the bus lanes, whereas the city's not doing that.
Pretty sure we hired people to take care of that already.
We should be. We should, that some of our tax money should be going for that. Yeah. So the Move All Seattle Sustainably Coalition is pushing for this transportation package, and I think it's if you want go online and search for the Mass Coalition Transportation Package and read it, you'll find some pretty good stuff in there. And the city council, particularly in Mike O'Brien's last term, is last year here or last few months on the city council as a city council member, is pushing to get some of that passed, particularly surrounding bicycles, which he's been a big proponent of during his entire time on the city council.
All right. You want to move on to national then?
Yeah, and just before we step into the national, I just want to remind people it's summertime and farmers markets are in full swing now. I've just visited the U-District Farmers Market this morning, and you'll find everything there that you could want in terms of produce. There's also fresh baked bread. There's honey and preserves. There is sustainably fished salmon. There's all kinds of great things you can find at the farmers markets, and this is the peak time to go visit them. So I'm putting in a plug for those.
Very good.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about national.
Okay, let's start with the Cherokee Nation.
Yeah, the Cherokee Nation has said this week that they will be voting on a person that they may send as a delegate to the U.S. Congress. And then they will appeal to the U.S. House of Representatives to seat their delegate as a delegate to Congress. Now, the U.S. House of Representatives and Congress have delegates from other U.S. territories. They're non-voting delegates, but they do represent those territories, particularly when Congress is debating bills and policies that pertain to U.S. territories like Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, Guam, the Marianas Islands, and other territories at the U.S. particularly in the U.S. House of Representatives. And the Cherokee Nation, in one of their treaties that goes back to the 1830s, the treaty that led to the Trail of Tears, that treaty also contained an article that allows the Cherokee Nation to send a delegate to Congress. And the Cherokee Nation is now at the point through their own tribal government that they want to now send a representative to the U.S. Congress, and they're pushing to do that now. They will be, if they succeed and Congress votes to allow their delegate to be seated in the House of Representatives, they will be the first Native American tribe in the United States to send a delegate to Congress. Now, that delegate, if they are seated, would not represent all Native American tribes, just the Cherokee Nation. So other tribes, if they have those clauses in their treaties, and they should be reviewing their treaties too, if they have that kind of clause in their treaties, they would be free to, and I hope will, vote to send delegates to U.S. Congress too, because it is long overdue now for U.S. Congress to have a real representation of tribal interests there. Now, there are four Native American representatives in the U.S. Congress right now, two Republicans and two Democrats, but they don't represent Native American interests. They represent their districts in Congress, and it's very, very important that tribes have representation too. And I think this is a good sign. It's particularly a good sign for tribal governance that these tribal governments are running smoothly, they're running well, and they're looking towards their national interests, not just their tribal interests for their members or for their reservations, but they're looking beyond to how their interests are being represented nationally. So this is, I think, is a very interesting development.
Hmm. All right. Did you want to do the, you'd been doing before your break last week, the presidential candidates. Did you want to jump to
that? Yeah, let's jump into that. Okay. Evaluating the presidential candidates on various issues. This week, I want to look at criminal justice reform. Now, the Obama administration got a lot of support from African-American voters, not just because Barack Obama was a black man, but also, particularly in the second term, because the Obama Justice Department responded to the Black Lives Matter movement in ramping up the Department of Justice's investigation of use of force policies and biased policing in several police departments that led to lawsuits and consent decrees with several police departments, including the Seattle Police Department. And that's a development that, while it was just the beginning of criminal justice reform in America, was a hopeful beginning. And I don't think we saw the Democratic presidential candidates in 2016 really pick up on that much. Now, Hillary Clinton wooed the African-American vote in 2016, probably more than Bernie Sanders did. Bernie Sanders did eventually respond to criticism that he wasn't addressing African-American or issues that were important to people of color. But I don't think either he or Hillary Clinton really committed to saying that they would carry on work begun under the Obama administration Justice Department in reviewing police departments that are accused of excessive use of force or biased policing. I think they should have. That was a missed opportunity, and that they should have. So it's really worth asking, what are the current Democratic candidates' policies on criminal justice reform? Are they going to commit to doing that, and are they going to take it further, you know, into broader systemic reform? So let's take a quick look at that now. Joe Biden, he's the, and I'm going to look at the top five, like I have in past weeks, the top five polling Democrats. Joe Biden, his approach is the top down. I call it the top down approach. Biden's website lists his criminal justice policy first before any of his other policies. That's worth mentioning. And I think this is consistent with the Obama administration's use of the Department of Justice to pursue investigation of police departments. Biden was, I think, part of that approach, too. So he is making it a key part of his campaign. But it's essentially a top-down approach that began in response to the Black Lives Matter movement and really looks at it as, what can we do from the federal level to kind of just sort of make sure that the police aren't abusing their power. Reform the whole system. So what Biden wants to do is, he wants to reduce the number of people in prison and jails while also reducing crime. He wants to root out racial, gender, and income-based disparities in how laws are enforced and in sentencing. He wants to change the focus of prison from just warehousing people to rehabilitation. He wants to remove the profit motive from the criminal justice system, and he wants to address the underlying causes of crime: poverty, lack of educational opportunities, physical and sexual abuse, and mental health and substance abuse. And this is these goals are common among all these Democratic presidential candidates. I see them throughout all of their criminal justice policies. They all vary in how they would go about tackling those issues. So how Biden would do it, he would create a $20 billion grant program, federal grant program, to help states shift from incarceration to crime prevention. Okay, so in an era when we're running into massive federal deficits, that's going to be a heavy lift for Congress there in the budget process. He wants to make pre-kindergarten schooling available to every 3 and 4 year old child, triple funding for the Title I funding, that's funding for low-income school districts, give every high school student the opportunity to earn advanced college or job training credits while they're still in high school, and he wants to make community college free for all students, and most of these other candidates have similar policies as well. He wants to expand funding for mental health care and substance abuse treatment. He wants more diversion services so jails don't become warehouses for homeless people, people with disabilities, or people with mental health issues or drug addictions. He wants to expand the U.S. Department of Justice to address police and prosecutorial misconduct. That's a key step that was taken by the Obama administration that's been dropped under Donald Trump. Biden would like to take it further. And he has a host of other judicial system reforms, including more funding for public defenders, eliminating mandatory minimum sentences, decriminalizing cannabis, eliminating the death penalty, stopping the use of private prisons, and investing $1 billion per year in juvenile justice reform, including pushing states to end the incarceration of kids. And there's a lot more. He's pretty good on this policy, in other words, and he sees that there are broad reforms that need to be made. And it's one area where Biden really knows his stuff. But again, it's an institutional top-down focus here. And a lot of what he wants to do will be expensive, and it's going to rely on the will of Congress to allocate funding at a time when we have huge budget deficits. So much of his program may remain out of reach unless Biden and Congress are willing to raise taxes, and raise taxes quite a bit. Now, Elizabeth Warren is number two in the polls right now. She has a holistic economic approach. That's what I call it. She wants to spend money on community services to lift people up and make communities safer, including policies and programs that recognize the rights of LGBTQ people, programs to make healthcare affordable and accessible, more mental health and drug treatment programs, and investing in evidence-based violence intervention programs that have proven effective at the local level. She wants to break the school-to-prison pipeline by providing more counselors, social workers, psychologists, and school nurses in our K through 12 schools. She wants to fully fund the Office of Civil Rights in the Department of Education. She would commit $500 billion over 10 years towards the goal of ending homelessness in the U.S. to create 3.2 million new housing units and help low-income families and families of color to buy homes. She wants to repeal the 1994 Tough on Crime bill. She wants to end the war on drugs, legalize marijuana, erase past convictions, expand diversion and treatment programs. She wants to end programs that criminalize poverty, including cash bail, fines and fees levied before your case is heard in court, and cap the assessment of fines and fees at a percentage of income for low-income people. She would pass new laws that hold large corporations and their managers accountable for breaking the laws and not allow them to skate. She would resume the Obama Justice Department's investigations of local police departments for excessive use of force and biased policing, and she would empower state attorney generals to do the same. She's the only one, actually, who mentions that. She would like to implement a grant program to set up civilian oversight boards of local police departments, and that's also something that Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg have mentioned they would like to do. She would establish a federal standard for the use of force and increase federal funding for law enforcement training in implicit bias, recognizing discrimination, and utilizing de-escalation tactics. She would separate law enforcement from immigration enforcement, demilitarize police departments, and expand the use of body cameras. She would expand funding for public defenders, appoint a diverse judicial bench, and rein in prosecutorial abuses. She would eliminate private prisons, et cetera, et cetera. There's much, much more. Warren has very specific plans, and a lot of them. But she mostly likes to talk about criminal justice as part of a broader holistic effort to improve the living standards as well as the security and expand economic opportunity for all Americans. It's really her economic focus and viewing crime as a function of poverty that prevails in her approach, which is why I call it the holistic economic approach. Bernie Sanders, his approach is the ground up versus Joe Biden's top-down approach. Bernie Sanders starts out by saying he would ban private for-profit prisons, ban them outright, and end profiteering throughout the criminal justice system, including public defender fees, court fees, diversion and substance abuse treatment fees, and other court costs that the poor just can't afford. He would end cash bail by withholding federal funds from states that use cash bail, because they don't all use it. He would revitalize the Justice Department's use of consent decrees and federal lawsuits to address constitutional violations by police departments. He would mandate criminal liability whenever the police violate a suspect's civil rights, instead of it being a civil liability. He would establish national standards for the use of force by police that de-emphasize de-escalation tactics. He would increase funding for officer training on implicit bias, crisis intervention, de-escalation, et cetera. He would end federal programs that provide military equipment to police departments. He would provide grants for states and cities to establish civilian oversight agencies. He would establish federal standards for body cameras and the release of police videos and ban the use of facial recognition software. I believe he's the only one of the top candidates who said that he would ban the use of facial recognition software. He would triple federal spending on public defenders to $14 billion per year and take other actions to ensure that every suspect has adequate legal counsel. He would abolish the death penalty and mandatory minimum sentences and three strikes laws, expand compassionate release programs, and provide more sentencing alternatives. He would spend $25 billion to help end homelessness and the criminalization of the homeless. He would end the war on drugs by legalizing marijuana, providing no-cost substance abuse treatments, and legalize safe injection sites and needle exchanges, which are, I think are also mentioned by a couple of the other candidates, including Elizabeth Warren. He would enact a prisoner bill of rights that would end solitary confinement. This is interesting, his prisoner bill of rights. End solitary confinement. End the prosecution of children as adults and provide medical care, vocational training, a living wage for work performed while in prison, and the right to vote. Also the protection from physical and sexual abuse and access to your families when you're in prison. That's a unique aspect of his criminal justice reform, is his prisoner bill of rights. And there's much more. Sanders' plan is really a bottom-up approach, which looks at the criminal justice system through the eyes of folks who are going through the system and who are living in communities that are on the front lines of policing and prisons in America. So that's a major departure from the other candidates there. Kamala Harris, now, her criminal justice policy is very thin, which is surprising given that she's an attorney. She should know the criminal justice system inside and out and have much more.
She was a prosecuting attorney.
But she was a prosecuting attorney, yeah. I call her plan the few minor tweaks plan. She would double the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice and renew and expand investigation of police departments in the use of consent decrees. So yes, she's willing to take the Obama administration's first steps further. She would support legislation to end racial profiling. She would legalize marijuana. She would reform federal sentencing laws, end private prisons, and push states to prioritize drug treatment over incarceration for drug offenses. So she's for diversion programs. She would seek a federal moratorium on the death penalty, but that's not an outright ban necessarily, and it wouldn't push states to ban the death penalty. She would increase investments in reentry support and job training programs, et cetera. So for an attorney, she really should have more detailed criminal justice reform plan, right? But again, she was a public prosecutor and an attorney general, not a public defender. So in her eyes, the criminal justice system is probably pretty good overall. It just needs a few of these little tweaks. So that's why I call her plan the few minor tweaks plan. Now, that brings us to Pete Buttigieg. His plan, I call it the arbitrary quota plan. Now, it's not bad. He would do a lot of the same things that Joe Biden would do and some of the same things that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders would do. But he immediately comes out and says he wants to reduce the number of incarcerated people nationwide by 50%, but doesn't supply any background for that number. Where is it coming from? You know, is it doable? You know, who are those 50%? He does just go on to say some specifics, like he would legalize marijuana, reduce drug sentencing, including retroactively, and expunge past convictions. He would eliminate mandatory minimum sentences, abolish private federal prisons, and incentivize states to reduce the use of private contractors, so not necessarily abolish them. He would support states that eliminate the for-profit bail industry and work with states and municipalities to cap the amount of revenue that they get from fines and court fees. He would double funding for grants to states that commit to criminal justice reform, with no specifics of what that reform would be. He would nominate judges from underrepresented backgrounds, so women, people of color, public defenders, and civil rights attorneys. He would support a constitutional amendment to abolish the death penalty. That's a difference there. Although supporting a constitutional amendment means that it could very well not pass at the federal level, since there's a higher bar for a constitutional amendment to pass. He would reduce the over-reliance on solitary confinement, but not end it altogether like Bernie Sanders would. And he would restore Pell Grant access to prisoners, extend Medicaid coverage to cover prisoners, increase funding to states for job training for the incarcerated, and restore the right to vote immediately upon a prisoner's release, but not while they're still incarcerated, as Bernie Sanders would do. So Buttigieg has a little more going here than Kamala Harris, but he falls far short of Bernie Sanders' prisoner bill of rights or Elizabeth Warren's holistic economic approach. And Buttigieg's arbitrary quota of 50%, it just seems to me like it was pulled out of thin air just to kind of set him apart from the other candidates. So that's my roundup of the criminal justice policies of the top candidates. I really was impressed with both Elizabeth Warren's and Bernie Sanders' policies. Joe Biden's policies are not bad. They just take a top-down approach. Kamala Harris was disappointing, very disappointing to me. And Pete Buttigieg, I kind of feel like he's got some good elements, but it's not as good as some of the other candidates. Now, I also want to mention, too, that the cutoff date was Wednesday at midnight for candidates to qualify for the September debates. A total of 10 candidates have qualified: Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg. Those are the top five. And then the other five are Beto O'Rourke, Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar, Andrew Yang, and Julianne Castro. Tom Steyer, the rich guy, he just missed qualifying. He needed to reach 2% in only one more poll. So if the requirements don't get increased for the October debate, he could very well be on the stage for the October debate. Because there's only 10 candidates for the September debate, there will only be a one-night debate. It won't be spread over two nights. Now, candidates who've recently dropped out of the race include Washington Governor Jay Inslee, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, former Governor John Hickenlooper of Colorado, and Representative Seth Moulton of Massachusetts. Additional candidates may withdraw soon. Unfortunately, conservative Montana Governor Steve Bullock has said that he's going to stay in the race through the Iowa caucuses in February, whether or not he eventually gets back on the debate stage or not. I find that kind of unfortunate, because in my view, Steve Bullock is really more of a Republican than he is a Democrat. It's just that the Republican Party has gone to the far right, too far to the right extreme end for him. So that wraps up my evaluation of the candidates for this week.
All right. So he's not going to make the debate stage
nope.
at this point. Well, maybe he can be
no,
like
neither.
A,
he and Tulsi Gabbard. Tulsi Gabbard was close. She needed a couple more polls with 2%, but didn't get them. She could also potentially make the October debate as well.
All right, moving on. Methane emissions and proposed rules for
the Trump administration's EPA announced a rule on Thursday, a proposed rule on Thursday to roll back regulation of methane emissions, the most potent of the greenhouse gases. The new rule would eliminate federal requirements for oil and gas companies to fix methane leaks from their oil and gas wells, in their transport pipelines, in their storage facilities, and in other infrastructure. This comes in spite of the fact that major oil companies have asked the Trump administration to not roll back the methane regulations. This is one of just a series of rollbacks by the Trump administration of major environmental regulations. So far, they've worked to overturn 84 environmental rules since January 2017, in just a little over a year and a half. Some of them include gutting the Endangered Species Act, scrapping the Clean Power Plan, even opening public lands to oil and gas drilling, including the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Now, this new rule would have to go through several months of public comment and review, but it could be finalized as soon as early next year, unless a court case is filed to stop it. The Natural Resources Defense Council has vowed to sue the Trump administration to get this rule halted. Now, methane currently makes up about 10% of the greenhouse gases in the planet's atmosphere. Although carbon dioxide is more plentiful, methane has 80 times the heat-trapping power of CO2 in the first 20 years after its release into the atmosphere. Methane now accounts for about one-fifth of the global warming that has occurred over the past century. The largest human sources of methane in the atmosphere are from the oil and gas industry, which accounts for about one, little over one third. Livestock, which accounts for 27%. So all you folks who are trying to move towards a more vegetarian diet, there's some incentive for you there. And the decay of organic waste in landfills accounts for about 16%. So if you're thinking about reducing your waste and not wasting food by just throwing it away, that's another incentive for you right there. Of course, this is not the first time that the Trump administration has gone after federal methane regulations. Scott Pruitt, Trump's first EPA administrator, attempted to suspend these methane regulations back in March 2017, shortly after he took office, but was stopped by an appeals court ruling. Large oil and gas companies have even urged the administration to tighten the rules, not to loosen them. And that's because big oil companies have an edge on smaller companies when it comes to being able to afford and deploy the technology to clean up their emissions from their oil and gas drilling. And in fact, many of them have already made big investments in that technology. It's small oil and gas companies that have urged the Trump EPA to ditch the rules. Big oil companies are also very heavily invested in making the switch from oil drilling to natural gas drilling as a clean power source. And they don't want methane emissions to sully that image. This could further drive the push for, if in fact methane emissions do turn people off of natural gas, that could further drive the push for truly clean and renewable energy sources like solar, wind, and wave power.
All right. We only have a couple minutes left. Do you want to touch on immigration news? Can you squeeze any of that in? And
I think I can. Let's see here. The Trump administration this past week, you know, announced that it didn't really announce it, actually. They just sent letters to immigrants telling them that they were revoking the deferred action program for migrants who came to the U.S. for life-saving medical treatment. That's yet another extremely inhumane act of the Trump administration over their extreme right-wing racist immigration policy to literally take folks who are taking advantage of a program to come to the United States to literally save their own lives, to tell those people, no, we're sending you back home, which is literally a death sentence for most of them, because if they have to come to the United States for medical treatment, it's because they can't get that treatment at home. Mm-hmm. And it's not because they can't afford that treatment at home. Medical treatment will be cheaper in their home countries. It's because they don't have that treatment in their country. So literally telling those people that they are going to have to leave means cutting them off from their medications, cutting them off from access to doctors who know how to take care of them, cutting them off from the life-saving procedures that they need in order to continue to live. So it is literally passing a death sentence on thousands of people here in the United States. In addition, the Trump administration announced that they were revoking conferral of automatic citizenship to children born to military personnel stationed abroad, U.S. military personnel stationed abroad. Those folks, when they have a baby now, that child is not going to be automatically considered a U.S. citizen. They will have to apply for citizenship for their babies, just like any other person from a foreign nation. That was a slap in the face to U.S. military personnel this past week. Also, House Democrats on the Oversight and Reform Committee have been interviewing families who were recently transferred from border control facilities, migrant families. And they're finding that those families are still being held in unsafe and unsanitary conditions, especially for children. This comes after Congress approved in June $4.6 billion, with at least $3 billion of that money supposedly being spent to improve conditions in border control facilities. They're finding that those folks are, for example, they don't have enough diapers for their children. Toddlers are being fed burritos instead of age-appropriate food that they won't choke on. They're being told to eat food that's been dropped on the floor. One child was told to slurp up their soup off the floor before they would be given more food because they had accidentally spilled it. Also, they're being fed spoiled food. Parents are being pushed to sign documents in English that they can't read and don't understand without translation. They're also being denied access to phone calls, and to adequate medical care. Again, this is after Congress approved $3 billion specifically to improve conditions in border control facilities. Homeland Security this past week banned congressional representatives from visiting ICE and border control facilities. And so that struggle is still going on.
Fortunately, we're out of time. Any events?
Yeah, I do have three events.
Okay,
there's, go for it. On Tuesday, Labor Day with Robert Reich and Pramila Jayapal. So former U.S. Labor Secretary Robert Reich will share the bill with our U.S. House Representative Pramila Jayapal to talk about the state of U.S. politics and the labor movement. That's from 7:30 to 9 p.m. on Tuesday at Town Hall at 7th and Seneca. On Thursday, there are two events, a District 4 candidate forum hosted by the University Heights Center. That's from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at University Heights on Thursday at 5031 University Way Northeast. And Thursday also is Kianga Yamada Taylor, author of the book From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. She'll be speaking at Town Hall from 7:30 to 9 p.m. on Thursday at 7th and Seneca.
All good events. Mm-hmm. We'll be taping. I'll be taping the Monday night one.
Yeah. And I just want to make a push too. If you enjoy listening to this show, please tell your friends and also start tuning in on weekdays when we have other programming available. If you also want to support the station, we are all volunteer and all donation based. Please visit us online at www.kodxseattle.org. We have a PayPal button at the bottom, and we have a Patreon button at the top of the site. So consider supporting us with monetary contributions.
Yes. In addition, we can always use volunteers as well.
To run the board, to provide content.
Or just to pedal the generators.
Even to record public meeting and events for rebroadcast.
We need more of that. All right. So we will plan on seeing you next week.
Yes, I'll be here next week.
Very good.